Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Hey, do you remember your adolescence? The awkwardness, the experimenting with new behaviors, that sense of invincibility that allowed you to take chances you wouldn't dream of taking now. Humiliating mistakes, the powerful need to fit in, to belong to a group, and even averting your gaze. Would you be surprised to find that there are biological roots to those behaviors that can be identified in some of those other animals? Animals like condors and capuchin monkeys, rats, Thompson's gazelles, vervet monkeys, and even paramecia. The time has come for us humans to lower the curtain between us and those other animals on the earth and discover our common history and our commonalities, and it may be to our human benefit. So come along today as we explore zoobiquity, which looks to animals and the doctors who care for them for answers to humankind's pressing health concerns. Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media that's dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your show creator and host. And during this broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the radio show page of emotionalpro.com or blogtalkradio.com/FPL. You can also call us toll free, 888-498-0570, 888-498-0570. Our guests today are Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. For over 20 years, cardiologist Barbara Natterson-Horowitz has treated human patients at the UCLA Medical Center. She's developed imaging techniques, and she's lectured thousands of medical students, residents, fellows, colleagues, and community members. She's also a cardiac consultant for the Los Angeles Zoo and a member of the Zoo's Medical Advisory Board, as well as Director of Imaging at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center. She's won numerous teaching awards. She's a professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, and her writing has appeared in many scientific and medical publications. She earned her bachelor's and master's degree from Harvard University and her medical degree from the University of California in San Francisco. Catherine Bowers has written and edited fiction and nonfiction books and articles, and she taught writing at UCLA. She began her career in journalism as a staff editor of the Atlantic Monthly and worked for James Fallows, the Washington editor of the Atlantic, and for CNN International in London. She later served as an assistant press attaché at the United States Embassy in Moscow, where she received a State Department Meritorious Honor Award for her service. Catherine holds a bachelor's degree from Stanford University and lives also in Los Angeles. Welcome, Catherine and Barbara. There's so many last names. I hope you don't mind if I call you Catherine and Barbara. Thank you so much, and welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So I find this topic really thrilling. I'm an animal lover. I once thought of becoming a veterinarian, a psychotherapist, and the wife of a medical doctor, and this puts a lot of the things that I'm interested in to new perspective. So I want to talk about how, Barbara in particular, how your interest in zoobiquity got started as you learned about capture myopathy in animals and learned that it was, or saw that it was similar to Takotsubo cardiomyopathy in humans.
And very good. Yes, this is Barbara. Yeah, well, I'm a human cardiologist. I've been taking care of, you know, heart attacks and heart failure and all kinds of the typical human cardiovascular problems. And then a little under 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to join the medical advisory board of the LA Zoo and on occasion assist the veterinarians with some of their cardiac imaging needs, which meant that occasionally I got to go to the zoo and do cardiac ultrasounds with the veterinarians. And it was very, obviously, really interesting after so many years of working on human patients to be doing that. But on one particular day, I was asked to image a tamarin. Tamarin are adorable, tiny little South American monkeys. They live in the rainforest at the top of the canopy. And I was the animal was getting sedated, and she was very adorable. So I kind of crouched down to look into her eyes and to create a trust bond with her, the way I would do with a human patient. And as I was making eye contact, the veterinarian sternly put his hand on my shoulder and asked me to stop making eye contact, that I was actually frightening her, and that I might give her something called capture myopathy. So I did as I was told, but I'd never heard of capture myopathy, but I looked it up, and I learned that capture myopathy is a diagnosis that veterinarians have made when animals are very, very scared. Sometimes when they're restrained, they have a surge of adrenaline and adrenaline-like hormones that can sometimes cause heart failure and sometimes death. So I'd never heard of capture myopathy, but I had heard of something called Takotsubo, or basically fear stress-induced cardiomyopathy or heart failure in humans. And as I began putting this capture myopathy next to the human version, I realized that these were, if not very, just very related, possibly identical syndromes. And what was really remarkable about it was that whereas the human syndrome was characterized around the year 2000 with lots of fanfare for the people who had identified it, it turned out veterinarians had identified this syndrome, had been diagnosing it and even preventing it for over 50 years. And I was really at that moment excited about this idea that veterinarians knew all kinds of things that we physicians didn't know, but because our professions rarely talk with each other, we were just missing out on all of their wisdom and insight.
Wow. You're reminding me, this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but in November, our lovely little dog got a malignant histiocytosis, and we went to the vet who said that it was extremely hard to treat, and one other animal dog had been treated at UC Davis at a cost of $10,000 and died anyway. And we decided not to treat the dog. We decided that it was a death sentence for her, which it was. And then I said, why is it that veterinarian medicine seems to be going the route of human medicine, which is keep the animals alive at all costs? And she looked at me a little tongue-in-cheek and said, lawsuits. So very similar to what, I mean, talk about similarities, but it is a little tongue-in-cheek. So since that time, you say you've come to the conclusion that underappreciating our own animal natures may be a worse problem than the one that scientists have long warned about, that Jeffrey Mason brings up in many of his books, for example, which is anthropomorphizing.
Yeah. When I was going to school, and Catherine and I have talked about this a lot, for many of us, when we were coming up, and even in high school and then in college, there were these stern warnings against anthropomorphizing. It was as though that was, you know, very unscientific and very unintellectual, that we humans were, of course, extremely distinct and unique, and if we saw ourselves in animals, we were simply projecting, or we were being, you know, sloppily sentimental and not scientific. So I think a lot of us have that experience. But of course, you know, in the last 10 and probably 20 years, we are learning so much. We know, for example, that we share the majority of our genome with mammals, and in the case of certainly the great apes, we share the vast majority of our genome with animals. I mean, the chimpanzee genome is almost 99% identical to the human genome. And so we know that, and we've learned through brain imaging and many other scientific modalities how much we actually have in common with animals. So the question is it time to really update that view of anthropomorphizing, and instead of saying that's the risk in terms of being unscientific, that the real risk is if we are not open to these commonalities.
This is Catherine. Even every pet owner knows that you look into your dog's eyes and it's giving you some sort of emotional feedback, and yet you often hear, don't anthropomorphize what your dog is doing. They're just hungry, or they just need you to give them shelter. And we do think that this caution against anthropomorphizing, you know, needs to be in the back of your mind, but we need to really update it with the technologies that are coming out of the scientific research into animal cognition and animal physiology.
Yes, you know, I'm becoming known as the cat whisperer in my family. I've lured two cats living under houses nearby, including our own, into our home and to be part of our family. And the last one, I started over a year ago standing under my house saying to the cat, when you're ready, I would like to scratch your fur and scratch you under your chin and so forth. And within 2 days, I was doing that. And then I said, you know, when you're ready, you can come into our house. And the cat just kept doing everything that I said, which was interesting. So, Catherine,
I want to... verbalizing that?
I was verbalizing it, yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I talk to animals and children and people who are in comatose states. I believe they can hear and understand. And I have lots of stories, but that's not our business today. So, Catherine, you know, one of the things that stood out to me in Zubiquity was that veterinarians so often observe what animals are doing, and yet in human culture, when we see certain things, we judge them. And it seemed to me that the Zubiquitous approach helps us, or has the potential to help us, not judge ourselves so harshly in many areas.
Yeah, that was something that both Barbara and I noticed after many, many hours of interviewing veterinarians and hanging out with veterinarians, is that they have really, really honed and excellent observational skills. And, of course, human physicians do too, but I think that as humans, we're so focused on what's coming out of our mouths and in talking, but sometimes our language can obscure what we really mean. And yeah, sorry, were you about to ask another question?
No.
And can I just jump in here? You know, I'm not sure if this is where you're heading also, but your question reminds me of another thing that we observed, which is, although we physicians try not to be judgmental, we're just humans, and I think, frankly, sometimes we fail in this effort to not be judgmental. And we notice that, you know, veterinarians are looking at and treating many of the same disorders in animals that we see in humans, including self-injury, you know, what psychiatrists call cutting, in some instances addiction, in some instances obesity. And in the medical community, these patients get judged. You know, patients with addiction get judged, obese patients get judged, self-injuring patients, and it's really refreshing and I think instructive for physicians to look at the way veterinarians see these problems in their animal patients. They're simply, it's not about judgment or morality. It's about a medical problem, a neurological problem, a psychiatric problem.
Yes, that's very important. And that leads me right into what I wanted to ask you about next, because as you say, there are lots of areas like adolescence and sexual behaviors, eating disorder, overweight, self-injury, that have parallels in humans and in members of, I guess, what we could call the animal kingdom. And I would like to look at those, starting with overweight. I found that chapter very interesting, you know, where you talk about the fact that animals' weight goes up and down every year, usually with the seasons. Talk, either one of you, I don't know who has the better edge on that. I'd like to talk more about how veterinarians or animal behaviors deal differently with overweight than humans.
Well, this was something that when Barbara and I started researching this chapter, we had an idea in our mind that out in the wild, animals were naturally lean and fit. They have to forage or chase down their own food. Their food is usually organic and natural because it's not, you know, farmed and processed the way our food is. And we thought that this was just some sort of almost nutritional wisdom that animals retained inside their own bodies and brains. But what we learned is that animals, if given the chance, will overindulge, you could say, in if food is plentiful and available. And you're right, their weight goes up and down seasonally, but also depending on what they have to do in their lives. If they're breeding or lactating, they need to have a little bit of extra body weight. If they're going into a mating season, there's some animals that don't eat during mating season, so they bulk up ahead of time. And that was kind of a new way of looking at it for me, that you, that the goal is not to stay at the same exact weight day in, day out, but that in nature there's this more dynamic approach to weight. And in fact, when we spoke to veterinarians about it, they said, of course, if you, if your animal is staying at the exact same weight all year round, you need to take a look at what's going on. They expect their animal's weights to go up and down.
That's really great. And I like, too, that it seems like any animal, absent fear, in the wild it's mostly from predators, and also with a ready supply of food, is likely to overeat. That I found interesting. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, we also found that interesting. We frankly both, when we asked, you know, we learned a lot about our preconceptions in writing the book. I definitely had this idea that, you know, well, we humans can't control ourselves. You know, if there's a jar full of M&Ms on our desk, you know, we're the ones who will eat them. But animals, you know, would have self-regulatory mechanisms. They would eat until they were full and they would stop. I just assumed that. Well, it turns out that was exactly wrong. And we learned from a veterinary nutritionist that, in fact, almost every species, and actually he felt every species, if the animals were put into proximity with abundance, without fear, as you said, without predatory threat, that they would overconsume. And that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective because, you know, in nature, there always is fear, first of all, and there's also periods of scarcity. So if you're living in a situation where you know there's going to be scarcity and the risk of starvation, when you're confronted with abundance and ready access to abundance, boy, it's smart to overconsume. So in fact, yes, animals, when they have ready access to abundant food, will eat and eat and eat. We learned about many species that will, you know, binge eat. I mean, we talked to a guy who specializes in blue whales. And he told us that, you know, he can just from season to season when there's lots of you know, fish, krill around, the blue whales, you can just see them getting fatter, actually. And then during periods where there's less, he can see actually the vertebrae, the bones and the vertebrae on their spines. Hmm. So, yes, animals can binge eat. They will gorge themselves sometimes if they have access. And then, of course, at other times they won't have access to food at all and their weight can go down quite a lot.
I think the main takeaway for us was that human physicians and human nutritionists and just human dieters tend to look so closely at the individual when it comes to weight. And a veterinarian tends to take a much broader view, and they look at not only what the animal is doing, but what's going on in the world around the animal, whether that's social or the built environment around the animal or sort of the physical landscape.
Well, so if I'm overweight and I know this, from the ubiquitous approach, then the natural thing for me to do would be sometimes to allow myself to overeat and other times when I'm not so hungry to allow myself to not eat much at all? Is that the best way to do it?
I think there's a certain amount of listening to your body and looking around you and thinking about what's going on in your life, but I don't think that that a ubiquitous diet or a ubiquitous approach to eating would say just eat whatever, you know, eat however you're feeling.
Right. I think if there weren't a ubiquitous approach, it would be this. It would be that the environment is highly determinative of an animal's weight. So that, you know, veterinarians know this. If they want to change the weight of an animal, they change the environment. And a human could, an overweight human, could conceivably simply adopt that approach and say, okay, I'm not even going to worry about, you know, willpower, self-control. I'm simply going to go around my home, my office, my car. I'm going to look at how the environment is contributing to my weight gain. And that can be anything from making it harder to access food, forcing oneself to expend more energies to get at food, but really focusing on the external environment as opposed to, you know, putting oneself on yet another diet or, you know, another, you know, strenuous exercise regimen. And ultimately, actually, you know, a lot of public health experts feel that our built environment, as Catherine said, you know, our fact that we have, you know, elevators and escalators and segways and all the rest, that's contributing as much as anything else to the obesity problem.
Mm-hmm. Because we humans don't have to go to the trouble to keep ourselves alive and to find food to the extent that animals in the wild do, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That ready access to abundant, high-calorie food that's a problem for humans and animals.
But one thing that we think is interesting is that in parallel to our human obesity epidemic is an obesity epidemic in our pets. So cats and dogs are getting fat at approximately the same rates that human beings are. And in a way, that makes sense because we feed them. They eat the food that we make for them and put out for them and maybe leave overnight for them, give them extra treats, and don't exercise them the same way we don't exercise ourselves. But we were also interested to find that there seems to be increasing body weight in wild animals also. We found some examples of marmots that are getting fatter and wild rats that are getting fatter that takes it out of kind of our human control and makes us look at even bigger environmental things that might be weighing into body weight around the world, whether that's circadian rhythms in artificial light that's kind of throwing off people's circadian rhythms, endocrine disrupting chemicals in the environment. A lot of things that could be playing into it besides just the food that we put into our mouths.
Right. I found it very interesting about the light. I grew up on a farm, and I had a guest talking about who has a book title, I Can Make You Sleep, and it turned out that my learning early in life to go to bed when it was dark and get up when it was getting light actually makes it easier for me to get a good night's sleep. I'm 70 years old now, and I don't have any sleep problems whatsoever, never have. And so I was interested in the light. We need to take a break here. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about food, about anorexia and bulimia, and also I want to get to this very interesting chapter that you have on sex. So my guests today are Dr. Barbara Nadison Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. They're the authors of Zubiquity, through which they are connecting health in animals and humans. You can visit them on the web at Zubiquity, that's ZOOBIQUITY.com. Call in with your questions now. We're at 888-498-0570. You are listening to Full Power Living, and we'll be right back.
Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Remember that our upcoming guests are listed at the top of our radio show page at emotionalpro.com. Next week, Scott Tipps, who's president of National Health Federation, an international nonprofit consumer education health freedom organization, will be with me looking to stimulate some public dialogue about proposed guidelines for dealing with all vitamins and supplements offered to consumers since 2007. The government is suggesting that they go through the same process that drug companies go through in developing drugs, including extremely costly developing and testing processes, which is likely to raise the cost to the consumer. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. So join us on Thursday. If you can't listen to our live broadcasts on Blog Talk or Emotional Pro, subscribe on iTunes. And we also want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. I'm talking today with the authors of Zubiquity, Catherine Bowers and Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz. You know, yesterday, Dr. Natterson Horowitz, it was brought to my attention that a study of over 1 million people found that, contrary to what we've been told for years, and this I think would be interesting to you as a cardiologist, you may already know about this, people who ate as many as one egg a day didn't have a higher incidence of stroke or heart attack. This was done by two universities in China and the Department of Nutrition and the Departments of Nutrition and Epidemiology at Harvard. And so it was published in the British Medical Journal. I wondered if you've heard of it, and also, did you find anything out about animals that suck eggs and their cardiac health?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There has been, you know, a shift in terms of how we think about the dietary sources of cholesterol and how those contribute to heart disease in humans. So I think that's a little bit of a moving target, and the egg question per se has definitely changed, but there are lots and lots of factors that can determine whether any individual patient can tolerate a lot of dietary cholesterol or not. What's interesting with animals is that, you know, animals can get a lot of heart disease. It turns out, you know, heart disease is the leading killer of human beings in the Western world, but it's also a leading killer of great apes. And remember that we're one of the great apes. There are five great apes, you know, gorillas, orangutans, bonobos, and chimps, and us. And all five of us, we have high rates of heart disease. But the kinds of heart disease that they have are not the kind that we have. We typically die from blockages of the coronary arteries, the arteries that supply blood and oxygen to the heart muscle. And that's from the atherosclerosis that we get. Well, the great apes suffer not from that problem, but from a kind of heart failure, typically. So it's interesting that they don't seem to suffer from heart attacks the way we do, but they do have other kinds of heart disease.
And also, we didn't look specifically into egg eating and other animals, but I love your question. I love the idea of looking to the animals for that kind of information, and that was what we were hoping to do with Zubiquity, is generate hypotheses, get people asking questions, and involve physicians and veterinarians and, frankly, patients in this process of figuring out what contributes to our health and disease.
I really appreciate that. So let's get back to where we were before our break. There are animals that starve themselves, similar to anorexia, and others that regurgitate deliberately, similar to bulimia. And in Zubiquity, you say that in animals, binge eating, secret eating, night eating, and food hoarding are common. And I also like your comment that animal meals are not boring because every bite involves two things, getting food and avoiding becoming food. So this brings fear and anxiety and stress to eating, which also seems to be involved with the human disorders. So I wanted to have you expand on that a little bit, please.
This was something that was really surprising to me, was the idea that animals could get some of the behavioral or even psychiatric issues that we think of as being uniquely human. To me, the idea that an animal could have an eating disorder was, frankly, shocking. But the more Barbara and I researched it, the more we realized that the underlying factors that link these behaviors in animals and in people are very similar. And, for example, we came across something called thin sow syndrome, which can happen to pigs on pig farms. Now, pig society is pretty cutthroat, and it can be very stressful for young pigs to leave their mother's side and emerge into the pig social hierarchy. And and it's a crucial time for them, kind of the way it is for our own human adolescents. And pig farmers have seen at that very stressful time that some pigs, not all of them, of course, but some of them will be so overwhelmed by that social anxiety and the bullying that they experience in the herd that they will start restricting their eating. And some of them actually go on to starve themselves to death. And the physical characteristics that they take on during that time have some parallels to what psychiatrists see in human anorexia nervosa. The female pigs will stop going into, stop having, you know, their menses, will stop having a period. Their hair can get very, very coarse, and sometimes they even have extra physical activity, which is sometimes a kind of counterintuitive, odd thing that goes along with human anorexia nervosa.
Wow. I really think your description of animals with eating disorders, I have worked for a number of years with a parent who has an adult child with anorexia, and you know, the pacing, the constant movement, the you know, refusal to eat, et cetera, was such a perfect description. I intend to draw this book, your book, to that parent's attention too, because I think it you know, when I was thinking about all the pain the parent has gone through, what a relief to know that it's not entirely something you did, you know, as a parent.
I love that you said that, because we actually agree that, you know, it was really instructive to us that just knowing that these disorders happen in other species, I think can be can help in some ways with a little bit of the burden of guilt and shame that sometimes accompanies these diagnoses, and definitely for a parent. It's also interesting to think about how stress affects eating in us. I mean, we know that for some people, stress leads to overeating as a stress response. And for other people, when they're very stressed out, they can't eat. So in fact, if you look at the DSM criteria for depression, in some individuals, you know, eating will be disturbed, you know, in the overconsumption direction, and in other individuals in the underconsumption. So what's interesting is that we see that in animals too. So Catherine was describing this syndrome in pigs, in the thin sow syndrome, that looks in some ways like human anorexia nervosa. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, veterinarians know that certain marine mammals like beluga whales and dolphins, and certain great apes like gorillas, for example, and chimps in some cases, when they experience stress, particularly social stress, they will engage in this other behavior where they you know, consume, and then they self-induce vomiting. In the case of the great apes, they may rock back and forth until they vomit, or some of them will actually push on their abdomens until the vomiting comes. So that is considered a stress response in these great apes and in the marine mammals, just the way, you know, the binge eating and then the forced vomiting is in some ways a stress response for human bulimics.
Oh, that's really great. Wow. You mention in your book Dr. Jeffrey Mason, author of When Elephants Weep, and he's been on our show twice, and I had an opportunity to meet him in person when I traveled to New Zealand. And I drew a pattern from When Elephants Weep of how animals work on emotions that I have been teaching to people. First, they have an experience, then they allow themselves to have the emotion that's connected to that experience. They take action based on what they're feeling, and then they turn the emotion loose and continue on with their lives as if that emotion-producing incident never happened. And I have found this very informative to humans, especially people who have trouble turning emotions loose. And I know, Barbara, that you trained first as a psychiatrist before you became a cardiologist. Can you either speak to this or tell us some other emotional things that you were drawn to that animals illustrate for us?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's really one of the wonderful things about writing this book when we wrote it is that the barrier to recognizing emotions in animals, I think, has been broken down.
So hooray.
I think when Jeffrey was writing, there was still more of a resistance to that idea. That was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. So we have the advantage of, I think people are really beginning to accept that, you know, that animals do have an emotional life. What we think is really interesting is the question of, well, why? Why do animals have emotions? Why do we have emotions? What evolutionary advantage do emotions give an individual? You know, what fitness-enhancing advantage do emotions provide? And so I love your description of the animal has the experience, then has the emotions, and then acts based on the emotions. And that's precisely what we sort of have come to the conclusion. We interviewed evolutionary biologists and others that emotions help guide an animal to make good decisions. And by good, we mean fitness-enhancing decisions, decisions that keep them safer, that provide them with more reproductive opportunities or more resources. So if you take the example of anxiety, which you know, is pervasive in humans, well, an animal who did not experience, let's say, fear would be in danger. An animal, on the other hand, who felt anxious or fearful when danger was around would likely take protective steps. On the flip side, positive emotion accompanies behaviors which are what the evolutionary biologists call fitness-enhancing. So the pleasure associated with eating, the pleasure associated with sex, the pleasure associated with social company, those pleasure rewards likely evolved to reward an animal for engaging in behavior which improved its ability to mate and to survive.
Wow. Let's go from that to adolescence. That is a wonderful chapter in Zubiquity, how essentially almost every animal has a period of time when they leave the comfort of the home, the nest, the herd, and evolve into their own adult life, and how many similarities there are between animal adolescence, if you will, or adults coming of age, and humans. Catherine, maybe you would talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, Barbara and I loved making the connections in this chapter, not only because we have children who are emerging into adolescence themselves, but also just because, for me, it was a real hiding in plain sight that, of course, animals are not born fully mature. Almost nothing living on our planet is born fully mature, and everything needs to go through this process of going from safety of the kind of child state into the more dangerous areas of taking care of themselves. We had the opportunity to go visit a marine biologist up in near Monterey, and she studies sea otters. And we went up there and we're watching these sea otters, and she was telling us about the different ways that they go out there and look for food in their natural environment. And there's this one area off the coast called the Triangle of Death, and it's an area that the fully mature male sea otters rarely venture into, and adult females hardly ever go in there, and their babies don't ever go in there either. It's called the Triangle of Death because it is filled with all kinds of danger. There's hardly any kelp there, so there's no place to hide. It's infested with great white sharks that love to snack on sea otters. But there is one kind of sea otter that will go into the Triangle of Death, and those are the adolescent males, the daredevils of the otter world. And that's the jumping-off point for our chapter, to talk about risk-taking across many, many different animals and why adolescence is such a dangerous time, not just for our own human animals, but for other animals, and also why it's a really, really necessary time, a time of learning the skills you're going to need to know as an adult, and how, in a way, if you don't take those risks as an adolescent, you're not going to learn what you need to know to be a fully functioning adult, and it's almost riskier not to take the risk.
Right. In my work teaching parenting, I have often challenged parents that children are constantly experimenting with their world. If you have a three-year-old who's got four or five cardboard boxes, they'll experiment with sitting those boxes on top of one another until the pile falls over. But when your children get to adolescence, they've got some other kinds of things to experiment with, like cigarettes and drugs and cars and things that they can hurt themselves with, but they still are driven to experiment. Does that fit?
Yeah, that's definitely true. People who study vervet monkeys, zebra finches, certain zebra fish, they notice that around adolescence there's a decreased fear response, and that adolescents are the first to run over and investigate a new object if you introduce it to an animal in the wild or even in an enclosed situation.
Uh-huh.
So yes, they do have this sort of innate curiosity at that age, which frankly is this counterintuitive way of getting them to know their enemy. If they can go up and find out what the thing that might kill them later as an adult, if they can get some experience with that at a young age, assuming they live to tell the tale, they're going to be, a more informed adult later in life.
Right. I think even in Zubiquity, you talk about gazelles that trail their predators, for adolescent gazelles.
Yes. Yeah. Those gazelles are really interesting because when they're babies, they are protected by their mothers, and they're actually protected by their hearts because their hearts are really sensitive to fear and alarm. And they will slow down to keep the animals still. But at a certain point, those animals need to leave the nest, and they have a whole different physiological reaction that takes place. They will, when they're chased by a predator, they sometimes will just fling themselves into the grass in front of the predator, and sometimes that won't be enough to keep the predator from attacking them. But it is interesting that they will also sometimes just approach their predator, follow them around. The predators are cheetahs. And so people who study gazelles and cheetahs have noticed the adolescent gazelles actually following cheetahs around. And sometimes the cheetahs will just give up and say, I'm not going to deal with you anymore. I'm going to leave. But, you know, sometimes they do die from that, what's called predator inspection behavior.
Uh-huh.
And getting back to the human side again, you were talking about drugs and alcohol and fast cars. I would say that it's very dangerous to be an animal teen, let's say. But we humans have dialed up the risk with our designer drugs and fast cars, and so it takes a risky time and makes it even more risky.
Right. Interesting. I just realized last night I had a dream about my son, who's actually 35 at this point, but he was on a mountainous road with me in the car with him, and he was backing his car down at a fast speed, and I just connected that it probably got stimulated by reading your book.
Yeah, there's something about how that concern never goes away, that concern for our offspring. Barbara and I haven't written about this part, but we think that has fitness-enhancing qualities to the survival instinct for our own children.
Uh-huh.
It's also really interesting. Some people are beginning to speculate about the survival and fitness benefits of grandparents, that they're in the wild, there are some long-lived species where the older members of the group actually provide for not only the adult children, but their offspring.
Huh. Well, I know my son keeps saying, I'm the elder. You make the decision. You're the elder. So there must be some relevance to that. Okay, we're up to our second break. Please call in with your questions, 888-498-0570. I'm talking today with UCLA cardiologist Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and writer Catherine Bowers about their recently released book, Zubiquity. When we return, we're going to be talking about sex, so come on back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
That emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us, 4 things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. We're back here on Full Power Living with Zubiquity authors Catherine Bowers and Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD. And I also want to thank a previous guest, animal behaviorist Erin Hanahoe, who brought Zubiquity to my attention. Thank you, Erin. This has been a fascinating exploration. So, also, I want to remind you that the website for the book and other information, and including a blog and all kinds of wonderful information, is zubiquity.com, zubiquity.com. So there's so much to talk about regarding sex and sexuality in Zubiquity, and I note that when you talked with veterinarians, it put kind of a new twist on things, bringing some of what I talked about earlier, where we may be less judgmental about sexual behaviors of humans once we understand that almost all animals behave in similar ways. So tell us about koalas and the clap, just briefly.
Right. Well, we couldn't resist that alliteration, but yeah, animals, as you can imagine, animals like us, if they practice, if they have multiple sexual partners, and they don't practice safe sex, which, you know, obviously they don't, that they spread, you know, bacteria and viruses and other pathogens back and forth. So, of course, sexually transmitted diseases are common in animals, and in the case of the koalas in Australia, there's really a rampant epidemic of the same kind of chlamydia that affects us, and it's affecting them and causing infertility and blindness in some cases. And actually, in some wildlife veterinarians are worried about the survival of the koalas because of this epidemic. But lots of other animals get STDs. Dolphins get HPV and herpes, and it goes on and on.
Yeah. Even animals that aren't warm-blooded that... frankly, I'd never even really thought about their sex lives, but they do sometimes have they penetrative sex, and they can pass these pathogens back and forth. Crabs, insects. In fact, some of the diseases that insects can transmit to us are actually sexually transmitted between the animals.
Thank you.
It was really. When we said, you know, that is a separate chapter, the STD chapter, from the general sexuality chapter, but it did get us thinking about, you know, what kind of sex animals have, because I guess until we wrote this book, I mean, I certainly sort of had this idea that we humans have sex, of course, to have babies, but also for pleasure and for bonding and for plenty of reasons, but I just somehow assumed that animals, well, they just do it to, you know, reproduce. And boy, was I wrong, because it turns out that animals do seem to engage in lots and lots of non-procreative sexuality, and it seems that they also experience pleasure with sex. We talk about the comparative orgasm in animals, and we talk about all kinds of non-procreative sexuality that animals engage in.
And the question is, what does this have to do with human beings and human health? And the answer is, you know, if we're going to, there's kind of a save the world answer, which is if we're going to look at how animals, you know, are decreasingly in our habitats, we need to figure out how they're reproducing themselves. But then also, are there behaviors that animals are engaging in that are risky that we can learn from? And then also, you know, what do these behaviors tell us about ourselves?
And I think another thing that was important is in the animal kingdom, you can't discuss these issues. You have to deal with them behaviorally. And and that, I think, is a really good thing that we might, our human medical people may think more, how can we deal with this behaviorally? I like that.
Yeah, so true. So we, you know, we tried to write the book from the perspective of what are the important human medical concerns that we see in animals as well, and what can we learn, you know, from the animals and the approaches of the animal experts, the vets and others. So in the case of males, let's start with male sexual problems, and then we'll talk with talk about female sexual problems. So one of the main human male sexual problems is something called erectile dysfunction. You know, the entire Viagra industry is based on ED, erectile dysfunction. So it turns out that, you know, not surprisingly, animals, too, can have erectile problems. We had the opportunity to visit a stallion breeding facility, and we learned that, you know, stallions who are professional breeders, right? They are literally they're purchased and then raised to sire foals. That sometimes they can't get erections. Sometimes they can't actually do the deed for a variety of reasons. And the vets are really okay with that. They give them a few chances, and if it doesn't work, they just say, okay, it's just not going to happen today. And the horse goes back to his stall, and you know, kind of, you know, cools his heels and comes back a different day. There's no stigma. It's recognized that sometimes an animal just isn't going to be able to perform. And we also learned that veterinarians and farmers and others are very aware that an animal, particularly a stallion and other animals, early sexual experiences can determine how sexually they are later in life as grown-ups. So they take care not to have a young stallion have too much sex too early. They are careful with which mares they allow a young stallion to be with so that there are no painful or traumatic experiences. But there's really a kind of an interesting understanding that, you know, the early experiences connect to the later sexual health.
You remind me when my son was about 13, he came to me and asked me to buy him some condoms, and I, with a particular girl in mind, and I told him that I thought he was too young for that, and we discussed things, and he had his friend call me and tell me the parents just didn't understand, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, I called his older sister in, and she sat him down and said, look, this is a big, important deal, and it's going to open you up emotionally, and you're sensitive, and this girl is going to move away here in a couple of weeks, and this is going to be too difficult. You don't need to do this. And he heard her, you know?
It's so, so interesting. As you're telling the story, it just, learning about the veterinary perspective, it did make me think that is so, well, I'll use the term translational. In other words, that kind of information, I think, can and should be brought over to the human side, to parents and to psychotherapists and others. Because there's just no, you know, when vets talk about these issues, there's no blushing, there's no giggling. It's just what it is. You know, on the other end of the spectrum, female sexuality we also looked at because the leading sexual problem for adult females, human females, is low desire. And, you know, there's a syndrome, and it can be serious. It can affect relationships and, in some cases, marriages. And it's interesting that veterinarians recognize that there are cyclical levels of sexual receptivity and interest among female mammals. That are expected, understandable, that you would not, a male lemur, for example, would know better than to approach a non-receptive female lemur. She would, you know, bite or scratch or kick. And, you know, of course, we humans, we can have sex anytime, you know, over the course of our own cycles, but there are patterns of hormones that probably make us more receptive other times and less receptive, you know, other times. So that perspective we thought was interesting and, again, translational for the human side.
Yes, and I liked your notation that most males did accept the turndown of the females. They might have to try a couple of times, but they did accept it. And there's one other thing. We tend to say that same-sex sexual behavior is abnormal, but in the animal kingdom, it's not necessarily You say clearly it's time to put to rest the idea that homosexuality is somehow unnatural, particularly if your definition of unnatural is something that's not found in nature. Can you comment on this?
Yes, absolutely. Same-same sexual activity is extremely prevalent in species ranging from, great apes and monkeys to big cats and lots of mammals, even to non-mammals. So it is really the norm. And there have been some wonderful naturalists and scientists who've been writing about this over the last 10 years. So we're actually not breaking this story, but we did feel it was important to go back and compile all of these species that are engaging in not only same sexual activity, but also there's lots of masturbation and other, as I said, non-procreative activities. And it's interesting why animals may engage in same-same sexual activity. In some cases, it has to do with their phase of life. If they're living in bachelor pods, for example, it can serve a social bonding function. But the point is that it is absolutely extremely common in nature. So we couldn't resist pointing out that if your definition of something that is natural is that which happens in nature, then one should reconsider saying that same-same sexual activity is unnatural.
So as we end, I'd like to ask both of you, what's a most important message that we humans need to hear from our animal kingdom brothers and sisters? What is it that they're saying to us that can help us live better lives?
We really feel that there are many takeaways from Zubiquity. As a physician, I think a central takeaway is that physicians need to communicate with veterinarians much, much more, that we have a tremendous amount to learn from them, and that collaborating with them can lead to a kind of species-spanning approach to health that can ultimately benefit, not only humans but animals as well. That it's time to really kind of erase what are really kind of synthetic barriers between our fields and have lots more collaboration. We have something called the Zubiquity Conferences, where we're pulling together academic veterinarians and physicians to discuss the shared diseases of different species, and so we're trying to do that. But on a larger level, for patients and parents and such, it's really hard to find any syndrome, any disease that is unique to humans. And there are a lot of important takeaways from that. One that's very dear to me is just the idea that to destigmatize problems like addiction and obesity and in some cases even cancer, just knowing that we humans aren't the only one that suffer from these problems, I think can remove a burden of guilt and shame. And then open up all kinds of interesting opportunities to understand these disorders from what they call a comparative perspective, which means comparing how they present in one species versus another. And veterinarians do this from day one of vet school, but we humans end up getting very, very focused on Homo sapiens, and I think we really lose the bigger picture.
That's a great statement. Thank you. Catherine, do you have any final words you'd like to say before we end?
I just would echo what Barbara said, but also from kind of the patient-parent perspective, which is just that we are so much more deeply connected to every living thing on this planet, small and large. And I think that a ubiquitous perspective can really help us see that.
Yes. Well, I just found it absolutely fascinating, and I want to thank you both so much for accepting my invitation to be on Full Power Living. You point out that a couple of things that came to mind as you were talking, that dinosaurs had brain tumors or had cancer, and also that human medical doctors, and veterinarians used to be one and the same person. So this isn't really new. It's more like revived. But we also have so much more information to share with one another. And we can see our health and emotional and behavior issues in a far less punitive or judged way. So I want to thank you for your interest, for your research, and both of you for writing such a great book. I want to tell you how delightfully the writing reads from my perspective. Lots of humor, lots of, you know, saying it exactly as it is, and it's a real pleasure to have read it. So thank you so much. Okay, remember, the website is Zubiquity, ZOOBIQUITY.com, and join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. And remember, next week we're talking about what our government is proposing in terms of restricting access to vitamins or supplements that you may now take. And so be sure to be with us and write us. Tell us where you're listening from. Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at emotionalpro.com. We love to hear from you. Robin Johnston of Fresh Talk Media is our producer. Thank you for a great job, Robin. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, thanking you for being with us and reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
Listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.